they disappear like the mist as it rises off the highway, where nights are too quiet and too loud. And they tug at your dreams in the middle of the day. They say the devil you know is mighty better than the devil that you don't know. That the stage lights and the miles will never show. Riches I bring you are nothing but trinkets, a mere currency between strangers. And if you ever love me, you would let me go. So goodbye, Antoine Saint-Exupéry.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion on this Tuesday morning. It is the 9th of January and a great pleasure to have you with us on this day. We have a lot to talk about, a lot of cool things, a lot of horrible things, and we'll try to make the best of all the situations that we have before us this morning. Let me introduce our panel to you, also welcome you to write to us and to be a part of the program, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will get as many letters as we can. We do not promise at any time to get to every letter. We certainly have never done that. We never probably will. But we do try to get a cross-section and get to as many as possible throughout the process. If you keep them short and to the point, it makes it even easier for us to get in as many as possible. All right. Let me introduce the group to you. Corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP, Rich Honan, is in the house. Good morning, Rich. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
It's good. I'm well. Thank good. You very much. I really appreciate you being here. The Empire Report's J.P. Miller is here. Good morning, J.P. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. Thank you for having me, Joe.
It's wonderful to have you on the program, as always. And for the second day in a row, we welcome political consultant and lobbyist Libby Post. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. It's good to have you.
I'm good. Thank
as
you
a regular.
So much. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It's
Being
it's
regular
nice.
Is important.
In so many ways.
Yes.
Yes. Would you like to introduce your special guest?
Yes. My special guest today is Grace Kwiatkowski, my graduate intern from Rockefeller College of Public Affairs and Policy at the University of Albany, where I teach, and she is full-time intern for the entire semester.
Excellent. For the spring semester.
For so the you, spring semester.
You have her right up until May.
Right. And she started January 3rd.
Excellent.
Very conscientious and really whip smart.
So you've only been there 6 days. Do you have anything to report?
Nothing new.
Okay,
I'm
no.
I'm learning a lot.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited.
Okay. When you have Libby's stories, let us know.
Oh,
right?
I will.
Okay, please. Thank you.
Absolutely.
There's an NDA she had to sign.
Very smart.
It was pretty long.
I can't imagine anything
that
I wouldn't already know, but I.
This is true.
But maybe, who knows? Grace, it's a delight to have you here. Thank you. We'll have your mic off, but if any time you want to talk, just raise your hand and we'll bring you right in on the conversation. All right.
You got it.
If you want to beat up on any of us, go for it. All right. Let me. Actually, before you turn her mic off, what's your what's the career goal?
Probably an attorney at some point.
Oh,
I really
Rich
like,
is an attorney.
I'm really good at reading and writing, so probably contracts.
Oh, see, I was not.
Like
so she'll do much better than I have.
Yeah, but you do contracts, don't you?
Yeah.
She's probably better at talking than I am.
What law school?
Probably New York or D.C.
Nice. Okay, good. And are you from the area?
No, I'm from Eastern Long Island.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, welcome. Very nice
Thank
to
you.
Have you here. Thank you very much for being a part of the program. Glad to have you. We like having a studio audience, even if it's just one person.
Happy to be
All
here.
Right. Let me get to the topics of the day, and we will start off. A lot of things going on, and a lot of those stories let's start with the Boeing 737 MAX 9 safety concerns. So this all started over the weekend when an Alaska Airlines Boeing MAX 9 jet had a midair blowout, and it was ascending, and then the side of the plane flew out, and then the what was the door or could have been a door. It wasn't a door, but it could have been a door for future configurations of the aircraft, went into some guy's backyard. So then the FAA said, oh, well, that's concerning. And then they said, oh, Alaska Airlines, how about you stop for a little while and let's see what's going on. And then very quickly they said all MAX 9s, Boeing MAX 9s, should stay and we'll see what's going on. So United Airlines and Alaskan Airlines are the biggest consumers of this particular plane, this particular configuration of this aircraft. So the National Transportation Safety Board said as the investigation has been going on, and there has been some indicator lights that have been going on, and they're finding a, sort of a theme here. But they also being reported are these loose parts on some MAX 9s. Now, I'm not an engineer. I'm not a builder of aircraft. But I would think that things are more likely to go blowing off a plane if they're not tightened onto the aircraft. So now federal investigators said late Monday that it was possible that the bolts that were supposed to keep a fuselage panel in place were never installed before the panel blew off an Alaska Airlines Boeing 737 MAX 9 in a near disastrous accident on Friday night. The fact that nobody was hurt is just unbelievable. That is one of the theories that the NTSB is pursuing in its investigations as it investigates the blowout. The board's chairwoman, Jennifer Hamendi, said at a news conference in Portland, her remarks came hours after United Airlines said it had found loose bolts on similar panels on some of its MAX 9 jets while preparing them for inspection after the mid-air emergency. And Alaska Airlines said it had also found loose hardware, quote unquote, on MAX 9s. The panel that came off of the plane, called a door plug, is placed where an emergency exit door would be if a jet had more seats. Ms. Hamendi said on Monday that four bolts, known as stop bolts, should have prevented the door plug from moving upward and coming off the plane.
Hence their name.
Bolts?
Door
stop bolts.
Yeah.
Yes.
And my immediate reaction when I read that last night was, only four?
Like, they're really big, and they've got washers on both sides. You know, and it really takes a lot to get them off, but it takes a lot to get them on, and I guess that was the problem here.
I guess so.
Yeah.
It's not
like big little boats.
Who would like to begin? JP, you want to start?
Sure, I will, Joe. I thought what was interesting that there weren't people sitting in seats 26A and 26B or whatever the number was, and the fact that there weren't people sitting in that seat,
yes,
saved some folks' lives.
Even though a guy got his shirt sucked off,
yeah,
a kid,
yeah.
I think obviously the good news is that no one was hurt and they are now addressing this. I was also kind of shocked that the quote unquote check engine light, that the decompression light was going on this particular plane for a couple times for the weeks previous to this incident.
Since the beginning of December.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Yeah, so we won't have it fly over the ocean. It'll just fly over land because, at 40,000 feet, you know, okay. Maybe you land okay.
I mean, it's like, it's sort of like, this is what I liken it to, and I apologize for interrupting, but it this is what I liken it to. You know when you walking out of a store and all the alarms go off, mm-hmm. and you think, oh God, they think I'm stealing something, and the woman just looks up and goes, oh, go ahead, it's fine. That happens like 80 times a day, and that's sort of what it feels like. But that's not good either.
Well, yes, and they're also, I don't believe, to Libby's point, there shouldn't be a category of planes that aren't allowed over the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, if they're not allowed over the ocean, they shouldn't be allowed over the air either, and or over land either. And so I was shocked by this. They are going to, I'm sure, do their best to get this fixed. And I know for me personally, when I see the check engine light on my car, it bothers me until I get it fixed. Can I go to the grocery store? Can I go on a 20 or 30 minute drive with this check engine light on? But then, you know, looking back at the statistics, I now, as I get older, get more nervous on planes for whatever reason. But statistics, over the last 12 years, there has not been, I believe, a passenger airline crash in the United States, which is a pretty remarkable record. And we get 40,000 to 50,000 car deaths every single year. So you're still more dangerous in a car than an airline. But this is a wild story.
Yeah. But if something goes wrong in a car, 149 people don't die.
Well, no. But if it's one of those big crashes, more than one person could.
No, I understand. But yeah. I mean, we see like vehicles that hold more people. Obviously, right. There's more concern because it has a greater impact. They're referring to it as an explosive decompression event. That is the technical term from the NTSB.
Which apparently would have been, because they were only at something like 16, they were ascending, they were at 16,000 feet or something. Yeah. That I'm told this. Okay, we're all going on third hand information here, right? I'm told that had they been at 35,000 feet, like cruising altitude, the depressurization would have been really severe. Like that's where people start getting sucked out of the plane.
Yes,
because of the outside pressure.
And it is so. What strikes you, Rich, as to how a company slash an industry deals with something like this? Because obviously there's the problem before them of what happened, but also you have all of these other jets now that are parked at airports across the country. Waiting for some word as to what they do next.
Yeah, one question is whether Boeing's CEO survives this. You know, I just don't know. And I haven't been following them enough to know whether they made a switch after the 737-800 MAX, whether it's the same CEO or not. I should have checked that, and I apologize. But that's the first thing. I don't know if this is as industry-wide. It just always seems to be Boeing. You know, now, to be fair, the 737 and in all of its iterations is the workhorse of, you know, most of the American regional fleet, you know, going city to city. So there's a lot of them up there. But that's a problem that's got to be fixed. And to JP's point, the fact that Alaska Air had, you know, the check engine light go on three times, you know, or the depressurization light. And they said, all right, and I think it was scheduled to be checked. You know, in a few days or something. You know, that's going to come back to haunt them.
To answer your question, Rich, David Calhoun has been president and CEO of Boeing since January 2020. He was previously Boeing's chairman and was appointed president and CEO after his predecessor, Dennis Muilenburg, fired amidst safety concerns regarding the 737 MAX after two fatal crashes that claimed the lives of 346 passengers and crew on board. Right.
The thing is that there were other companies involved in putting this plane together. And so the safety checks there didn't work. And then Boeing, I guess, didn't do its due diligence to make sure that they did what they were supposed to do.
Yeah, true. And in what is going to be a PR nightmare, so the name of the company that made the fuselage was Spirit, like Spirit Air or Airways or something. Mm. And so now you have, imagine you're the PR people, the branding people at Spirit Airlines. You know, and should I say that was not us.
That's a different company.
Yes,
right. Spirit Aero Systems.
Yeah. All right. So that's gonna be a tough hit.
And Spirit doesn't have a great reputation either, from what I understand.
Right.
So
look, you know, our worst thing is, you know, we don't take off and land on time, but you know, the doors do stay in the planes.
Yeah. Right.
You know,
so there is that.
Pick your poison.
Yeah, right.
You know,
you want speed or accuracy?
How do I say this without getting letters? You know, I don't want it to be seen that we're making light of it, but because no one was hurt, because no one was severely injured. or killed as a result. I mean, there is something just weirdly comical about a plane. Those pictures are so distressing, of just seeing that they kind of pan down and you see just a very typical plane, seat, and then you see outdoors.
Yeah.
And that's very disconcerting. But I think it also plays into all of our fears about, you know, if anyone has ever had any fear of flying, of what can happen. I was thinking of this last night, but, you know, when you're on a plane, I think we've all had this, where there's a moment where it'll just shake a little bit.
And right.
You're like, oh, this thing's just going to come apart.
Yeah. And everybody looks around, and you look at the flight attendant, and you're like, all right, they're fine.
So yeah, they're fine, not I'll worried. Play. Yeah.
But you're right. You know, we shouldn't underplay just how terrifying it must have been on the plane and how traumatized the people will be. But, yeah, it's going to be the amount of – I'm sorry to say, the amount of jokes and comedy bits that are going to come out of this. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of, so they said that Boeing sent instructions to everybody who has this plane on how to fix, you know, and I'm wondering if it's like an IKEA diagram with just like a wrench, you know, with
right,
a clockwise.
Yeah. Right.
You know.
Little
hex wrench.
Right. An Allen wrench.
Three times to the right.
Right.
And,
well, this will be the cold open on SNL.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So we'll see what happens with these aircraft. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll go to letters and we'll move on to other topics. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And before we do all of that, we will get a news update from our British friends from the BBC.
Turns out to be the same God, the same sky. We are slightly scared of death, a little bit afraid, so we celebrate everything we can think to celebrate.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. We have Libby Post and J.P. Miller, and of course Rich Honan with us. And while we were during the break, Rich said, "Well, will you get any letters on this?" And I said, "No, we've got a few letters." And Rich jokingly said, "Well, is anyone blaming Trump?" And I said, "Well, I don't think so." John writes, wasn't the airline deregulation part of Trump's agenda? Can we trust an airline to regulate itself when profit is the driving force? We can take the second part of that question, though, a serious question, right?
Yes. But no, actually, it was Ronald Reagan who deregulated the airplane industry, and Nixon. They did most of the deregulation. I mean, Reagan broke PATCO, which was the Air Controllers Union, and then Nixon was like, it used to be that they all had to have their pricing at the same levels, and
right.
Then Nixon said, no, you don't have to do that anymore, and so now you can go $99 from LA to Hawaii, or $9,000 from Hawaii to Australia, or whatever, you know, it is. But you know, we can all try to blame the Orange Menace for a lot, but let's blame him for the stuff that we can actually prove.
I love the letter. I love the creativity.
It's what you, I know it's what you've come to expect when you come here.
I also think, in general, when I think of deregulation, I think of it as business practices, not safety practices.
Right.
You would think that everybody wants heavy regulation of safety for airlines and cars and vehicles and heavy machinery and all that.
Yeah, I'm sure the deregulation did not include reducing the amount of rotations on the bolt.
Well, and Keith makes a good point. He said they expect us to take our belts and shoes off going through security, but the airlines can just ignore depressurization lights. I mean, yeah. Fair
That's
point.
Something to be said about
fair
that.
Point. All right. As a retired airline pilot from a major air carrier, I can tell you that the FAA classifies a loss of cabin pressurization event as an explosive decompression if the pressure loss occurs within 1 second or less. There are cockpit procedures delineated for this emergency, which we train for as part of our emergency procedures training in recurrent simulator training every 6 months. Well, as indicated, I would think as shown by the fact that no one was hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, they were able to safely land the plane. The pilots and the flight attendants did an amazing job. I mean, that they did what they were trained to do, which is incredible. You want it to work out that way in the most severe situations. So that's a great point from From Barry, three cheers for flight attendants. The recent incidents with Japan Airlines and Alaska Air show how important they are in keeping passengers safe and calm in dangerous situations. Absolutely. Let's see. One, I guess that is it for the letters on. Oh, no. Since the merger with McDonnell Douglas, Boeing has been under the control of the bean counters from McDonnell Douglas with a blatant disregard for safety and quality control. Only the stock price, shame on them. I don't know the spirit of that letter as to where it comes from of that knowledge, but.
Well, look, it's hard not to take a shot at Boeing on this, right? I mean, it's, and the other thing is it from a consumer standpoint, there's kind of not any synchronicity between, like, you can't decide. It's hard to decide, I'm not going to fly a Boeing aircraft. You know, you could say, I don't like Southwest, I don't like Spirit, I don't like United. Right. You know what I mean? But by the time, I mean, when you're making your flight arrangements, you know, you're four clicks in before you even look at, you know, what type of aircraft it is. You know, now maybe people will start doing that, and maybe the airports will start, the airlines will start self-selecting. But as a consumer, we're more removed from that decision than we are with most consumer decisions.
Well, and that's a great point, because I was thinking of this. I was noodling around planning a flight last night, and I clicked on to see, oh, what kind of plane it was, usually you're flying a couple weeks or months out, and I mean, who knows what the case is going to be then, and right. As planes change, you know, what are you actually going to be on? And that's, you know, that's another question.
Yeah. And the folks who fly a lot have a good sense, you know which routes they take, and usually know what type of equipment, you know, like if you're flying Allegiant out of Albany, which by the way is great. I've heard some stories differ. I'd rather fly the Airbus 320 or whatever they use than a 737. I mean, the headroom, I'm starting to look more for Airbus than I am for Boeing.
What about Embraer? What do you think about them?
But that's for the smaller regional jets. And
you're okay with them?
Yeah, they're great.
And Lockheed Martin?
Yeah, but I'm not usually going to the moon. Right?
Oh, okay. I just looked up and they said they make airplanes too.
It's not an unusual commute.
Yeah.
Well, it's a but it is interesting too, because I realize that I'm opening a whole.
Can of worms,
kettle of fish, whatever, however you want to say it. But I do wonder, the configuration of the plane is having to do with the seats. So this had the emergency exit door, if there were to be seats there that would have enough seating that would require that to be an emergency exit. And I just wonder how much overall this has to do with, now I say this as a big and tall guy, but you know, we look for comfort, and that, you know, you're not going to get that on most planes. And if you do, they charge you like $50 to get an extra inch and a half and a movable armrest, so you can fit your knees in the seat, because they're very worried about safety. But my question is, I mean, as you start moving seating to then make more money, are you sort of changing the design of the plane? I'm just asking this question.
On the inside.
Doesn't that have an effect on the outside?
Yes, and then it would have an effect on the outside. But I mean, maybe I'm just being naive. You know, when I look at the planes, I go in them often enough, you know, it doesn't seem like it would be so easy to move the seats around, because there is what it is. And there's, it doesn't look like there's any kind of movable contraption, movable, you know, stuff that you can just press the button or flip the thing back and you can move the seats up, you know. So it's like, how does that work?
Yeah, that seems like a weird.
Yeah.
It's like when you have, like in your car, you know, you have the option, you know, if you have this option, you know, it's in the dashboard, but if not, it's just something blank. I hate to think that, like, Boeing's making planes now. Well, we didn't get all the options on this one. We just got the base model.
That's right. Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah.
It's just weird.
Because I want the L.L. Bean edition.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. We'll go to, I want to go, I know we have. Having worked as a government contractor, in a government contractor business for 40 years, I can tell you unequivocally that independent overview is essential, as good people make mistakes and people that are distracted or lazy can create small problems to evolve into disaster. There was a clear failure in this event. Then Jeff says, just for reference, there's about 7,000 to 8,000 commercial flights in the air at any given moment, with more than 1 million people up there right now, 24/7. This goes on every day without incident. A person has a better chance of getting hurt from a door falling from the sky.
That is true, though. I mean, that is true. If you, one day, look at the map. You know, they have those flight awares and things. When you look at the map, that shows you how many flights are in the pattern at any given time. It's terrifying.
It is a lot.
And this situation on an airplane, because it happened on an airplane, because it's getting all this press, this is now grounding these flights. If this happened in a car, for instance, it would take multiple occurrences of this for... them to reevaluate.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just thinking about how, okay, so let's have another school shooting and nobody's reevaluating how easy it is to put everyone's life at risk with guns, right? Because of, oh, the Second Amendment, we're talking about a well-armed militia, not yahoos with guns. And, you know, we just had a shooting last week in Iowa, and the Orange Menace said, well, we have to get over it. I mean, it's like we do all of these things, safety in airplanes, safety in cars, you know, safety on roller coasters, yet anybody can go get a gun and shoot up their school. Where is the rationale behind that?
Fair question. Slight tangent, but it's just, I mean, to the letter of people going over everything, that you have to have oversight and you have to have regulation. But before this event occurred on for Christmas, I got a Lego set to build a Concorde jet. And I was joking before this happened, I was joking with my wife that as I'm putting it together, you have like each bag, there's different bags, and you put the pieces together, and there's directions, and then all of a sudden you get done and there's like three extra pieces, and you're like, and I said, normally I don't worry about that because they apparently, you know, sometimes just throw in some extra pieces, but I feel a duty when I'm dealing with a plane
to make
that everything work exactly the way that it
everything
it
is
should.
In its place.
We did get a letter to correct us. It was Jimmy Carter, they claim, and they're right, I believe, that Jimmy Carter deregulated the airlines. The Airline Deregulation Act came out in 1978, a federal law that deregulated the airline industry in the United States, removing federal control over such areas as fares, routes, and market entry of new airlines. The act gradually phased out and disbanded the Civil Aeronautics Board, but the regulatory powers of the FAA were not diminished over all aspects of aviation safety.
So
for rebuttal.
The airline deregulation began with initiatives by economist Alfred Kahn in the Nixon administration, carried through the Ford, and finally was done by Carter. So it did start with Nixon.
Okay.
Just to be clear.
Yes. In 1970 and 71, the Council of Economic Advisors in the Nixon administration proposed legislation to diminish the price collusion and entry barriers in transportation.
Not that this has anything to do with safety, but it also is, business-wise, a horrible industry to be in. They're constantly being bailed out, constantly going through bankruptcies. Yeah. We all, at least most people as consumers, treat airlines as a commodity. Whatever I can get for the lowest price to get me from here to there, I'm going to book it.
Right. That's true. We'll take a break. We'll continue and move on to another topic after this. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Cause I lied about the vertical, and I have never been.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Rich Honan, J.P. Miller, and Libby Post with us on this Tuesday morning. We've been discussing the concerns over the Boeing Air Max 9, right? And we do have a couple more letters that I want to get to, and then we'll move on to other stuff. Theodore says, to answer your question, there is a railing along the floor that the seats bolt into. They are easy to reconfigure. Socket wrench is all that is needed.
Yeah, and I think a socket wrench was all that was needed with the bolts, yeah, too, probably. But thank you for explaining that.
Okay, and then we have a couple more letters about the Jimmy Carter legacy. So
that's a nice pickup by the readers to go back by the listeners.
They're smart folk.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to other topics on this Tuesday morning to see what else we can discuss as a. Bring this up. Here we go. There is there's still questions that are mounting around the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's hospitalization. We talked about this yesterday at some length, and I will admit as we discussed this morning, we don't know really any more today than we knew yesterday. But except for the fact that Mr. Austin has left intensive care, he is still hospitalized. But there is this growing scrutiny of Pentagon secrecy over what happened. So for those of you who perhaps are not familiar with the story, Lloyd Austin, the defense secretary, is under doctor supervision at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Maryland. He was taken there by ambulance on January 1st while in, quote, severe pain with undisclosed complications from a December 22nd medical procedure that included an overnight stay. But their halting explanation of the situation and Austin's lack of transparency about what led to his health crisis have only amplified the scrutiny following revelations that Austin's senior staff declined to disclose the issue to the White House for days. The Pentagon said Monday night that it remains unclear when he may be released, but that officials intend to provide daily updates so long as he remains at Walter Reed, which seems like a good thing to say when you've kept it secret for the earlier part of the week. Rich?
This sounds like something that would happen in, like, the Trump White House.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
This is exactly the kind of chaos that people foretold for that. I don't even know what's going on here. First, we don't know why he was in the hospital, but the whole idea that his second in command apparently did not know he was in the hospital.
She was sick too. She had the flu.
Right. No. I think that was the chief of staff had
the
flu.
The
chief of staff had the flu, and that was one of the reasons why they didn't get the message to the White House. That was one of the first stories. His second in command was on vacation,
right.
I assume she obviously didn't know he was out of the office.
Exactly right, but that would explain maybe the first 12 hours.
Yeah. And then they tried to circle the wagons, but they kind of ran the wagons all into each other because they can't get their story straight. We still don't know what's going on. We don't know who's in charge. If I'm Biden, I got to fire this guy just for insubordination.
I mean, I was struck yesterday. We had Ambassador Fred Hoff on the show yesterday, and Ambassador Hoff, who has a 40-plus year military career, a distinguished military career, two-time Purple Heart recipient, said this guy should be fired.
And
received some pushback from our audience, but. I think the his point is that there is a chain of command, and even if he's a civilian, there's a chain of command, and you as a defense secretary have this whole group of people around you because you're a key element of the administration. And oh, by the way, we're involved in warfare around the world, so we kind of need the guy.
Yeah, people are shooting at us.
Yeah. So the idea that nobody really knows who's in charge at any given moment is disconcerting. JP?
A typical president gets a daily national security briefing from their national security advisor. And so how the president went for multiple days getting these briefings, if he's getting the briefings from the national security advisor without input from the Secretary of Defense, also went multiple days during wartime. We've got a war in Ukraine and Russia. We've got a war with Hamas and Israel. We just shot at, I think we bombed the Houthis.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
While he was in intensive care.
Right.
Well,
so
it just goes to show that we could still get things done.
So how the president didn't know about this, that, you know, I guess I don't know how often a president talks to their Secretary of Defense. I would think during wartime, every day, sometimes multiple times a day. How you go multiple days without speaking to the person and not even knowing they're in the hospital. You know, I only work with Libby maybe once a week. I think I'd know if she was in the hospital, you know? And she's not my Secretary of Defense.
No, it's a good point. And we were talking about this on yesterday's program, where they're apparently they have one meeting in-person meeting, or usually, unless their schedules do not allow, they have an in-person meeting, the President and the Defense Secretary, once a week. And then
that doesn't seem like enough.
Well, no, but they're also talking on the phone, and they're and
apparently
and
not.
So forth. But right. So, but my whole thing is like that you, what I don't understand about this. Well, there's two things I don't understand, as I mentioned yesterday, and I'll throw this to the group. What's wrong with saying I'm sick?
Well, there is that macho part of this whole thing. You know, or he doesn't want people to know what he went in for. And that's understandable. I mean, God forbid he went in for something really serious, like some kind of taking cancer out, right? And you can get out the next day. Or, you know, maybe he went in for a knee replacement. And you can, you know, they wanted me to go out the same day. And I'm like, I don't think so. You know, but that can be painful, too. I mean, there's all kinds of things. The fact that they're not being transparent about that, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense. If they would just say, this is what happened. This is what happened afterwards. This is why he's in Walter Reed. I'm his doctor, blah, 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 blah. It's just, I don't get it. I really don't get it. But I think part of it is that there are some people, mostly men, who don't want to seem weak at all, right?
Sure.
And it's a macho thing, and they don't want to, you know, say, oh, I had to have my gallbladder removed or whatever it might have been.
But those were all good reasons.
When it happened.
Well, those were all good reasons for not telling the public.
Right.
Right? But none of those are a reason for not telling
the president.
Right. If that's what happened, and it kind of sounds like that's what happened. I mean, the public, did any of us know that he was rushed to the hospital by ambulance?
No.
On
January 1st? No.
Right. Now, I understand somebody says, well, you know, I'm sure they bring up the whole national, you know, it's a national security issue. We can't. Okay. They ride that one a lot.
I would say that that's probably a fair criticism, though.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
Yes. We don't want to broadcast to our enemies that our Secretary of Defense is in a hospital.
But that avoids the whole thing of what we said before. There's the chain of command, and you got to tell the president, and you got to tell, and the second in command is probably thinking, you know, I probably would have put off my Puerto Rico vacation, you know, so I could have been, I don't know, in the Situation Room.
I know
the Fox Newses of the world, you know, my people, the conservatives, are making a big deal about the fact that this strike took place. But it's clear that the strike was something
that was planned,
that was pre-authorized. And they just said, you know, when you see this guy or this, you know, when you have this opportunity, take it. So that, I think, is a red herring. But I how do you put your second in command in that kind of position, you know, unless she knew? It's hard to believe.
Also, you have the president, sort of the administration anyway, doubling down, saying that President Biden retains confidence in Austin and has no plans to replace him. That from John Kirby, a spokesman for the White House's National Security Council, saying that Biden is focused on the secretary's recovery and looks forward to having him back at the Pentagon as soon as possible. Even in that situation, it seems like it would be okay to say, we are trying to ascertain exactly where the lack of communication took place and how we can, you know, better that. It would seem like you still have to apologize. Not apologize, but to
acknowledge
exactly. Right. Acknowledge the fact that there is a lapse.
Well, you know, the president's going to support him until he doesn't. And there will be a tipping point here, probably.
But there hasn't been yet, really. This president really doesn't fire people.
No.
You know, you could argue loyal to a fault, but I'm trying to think of somebody who's been fired.
No, nobody's been fired. Jen Psaki left.
Yeah.
People have left. But, you know, it's all according how far of a tipping point this becomes, with more Democrats calling for his replacement. He's not going to listen to the Republicans, but if the more Democrats call for his replacement, even Leon Panetta, you know, weighed in, said that he needs to be transparent because he was in the same position. So we'll see what happens and whether or not they stick with him or not, or whether what they managed for this to happen is Austin steps down of his own accord.
I mean, the other thing
that becomes easy. You know, I'm going to deal with my health issues,
right? And then you move on.
But there's an existing, I believe, there's an existing antipathy between Biden and the defense establishment. I think that goes back to Biden's early days. I think Biden has always you get the feeling that he isn't as close to the defense establishment as he is to, say, you know, Congress and the Senate. And you saw that a little bit when, you know, arguably he overrode some of the recommendations when it came to Afghanistan. You almost feel like he's a guy who feels like he's been pushed around a little bit by, you know, the Pentagon folks. And I think a lot of Beltway people feel that way. And so this might be the tipping point, because this is a personal affront. This is a personal disrespect to the president. I just don't know how somebody survives it.
Although, if Biden has confidence in him up to this point, and he views him as a really great defense secretary, and maybe they don't have someone to replace him, it's a tough situation for Biden to, if he thinks that he's done a great job up to this point. You're in the middle of war, and this is a the lack of communication is really the offense here, not for doing a bad job. I think it's a little bit of a tough situation for the president.
I know we have to come back. Yeah. Can we come back to that afterwards?
Absolutely. We sure can. We'll come back to that, and we'll continue our conversation. First News with Ray Graff.
Those were the longest nights with smoke and
good morning. Welcome
family
back.
Family drama.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. It's the airing of the grievances during the breaks. I want to get back to our conversation. Let me introduce everybody once again. Rich Honan is corporate attorney with Phillips Lytle LLP. J.P. Miller is from the Empire Report. And I rely on that every day. That is my barometer as to what I need to pay attention to in this fine state.
Thanks, Chuck.
So thank you for the work that you do around the clock. Libby Post, political consultant and lobbyist. And we talked about you yesterday with Ted Patricus.
Yes, I heard.
Oh, you heard it? Yeah.
I listened.
Yeah,
yes. It was very sweet.
Ted Patricus of the Retail Council of New York State wrote a book called Lobbying 101. And Libby was a chapter.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, it was very cool. And so we had a good, had a very nice conversation with Ted. All right. Before we went to break, we were talking about Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and his hospitalization at Walter Reed and going back and forth as to, you know, kind of this regular question of what did they know and when did they know it? As far as we can tell, to the best of our knowledge, that some 4 days went by before White House officials were informed. And what came out yesterday in the Pentagon press conference was that there were members of the staff that didn't know immediately, and they knew before the president did, which is quite interesting. As we try to make sense of this, Rich, you had asked for the floor when we returned.
Yeah, because JP made a good point before we broke, saying, "Look, if the only problem here is the communication issue, you know, serious though that might be, that's more of a process. The way I understand, you're saying it's more of a process issue, and that's something that you know people who respect each other can get over. And what I wanted to jump in and say was. I could see if that was the only problem, but my question was, and I understand this gets political, let's look at Austin's performance over the last, you know, couple couple of years. Afghanistan, in my mind, and a lot of people's mind, Afghanistan did not go very well. The Ukraine response was very slow and very tepid. Our response to the Houthi rebels that are actually hitting our people, has been, I think, disproportionately low. So I think that there's plenty of room for criticism of him substantively, that if you use that as the foundation, this type of thing could be a tipping point. I agree with you, JP. If this was the only thing, if things were going along swimmingly, then this would be something where, you get somebody in the office and say, look, I'm going to back you, but, that ever happens again, and you're done. I can understand that.
Well, let's see what happens. You never know.
So you think he's gone?
You never know. I think if he is gone, it will be a resignation. And none of this happens overnight or in a 24-hour news cycle. I have to disagree with you. Afghanistan was not handled well. We came out in support of Ukraine as fast and as strong as we could with money and trying to get NATO involved and all the rest of that. And so I think we've been standing pretty closely with Ukraine. The Houthis in Yemen, do we want to really start World War III? Because that's what we're on the brink of with what's going on in the Middle East right now, with our involvement with Israel. Israel's starting, thankfully, to pull back a little bit, but the Houthis are going after our ships and doing all the rest of that stuff. This could ignite World War III, and that's what I think Biden is trying to avoid, whether or not Austin is involved in these discussions because he's still in the hospital. None of us know. It's all conjecture. We don't know what's going on. We're not there. We're not even a fly in the room, right, on the wall. But I wouldn't say that every military response has been weak or not well thought out. We've got the Israel situation where you have the radical Christian right in Congress wanting to support Israel so that it's there when the rapture comes, not wanting to support Ukraine because they like Putin, because they like autocracies, right? And so there's that dynamic going on, as well as you've got the splits happening within the Democratic Party around Israel. It's a lot to juggle. It's a lot to juggle.
But that's what we pay the guy for.
I get that. I understand that that's the job. But there's all these competing priorities, and we are in a 24/7 news cycle, which I think has destroyed our ability to be discerning. It's like we sit on our couch with our remote. We want instant news all the time. We want bias confirmation news. I'm going to watch Fox because they'll tell me what I want to hear. I'll watch MSNBC because they'll tell me what I want to hear. So, it's more than just the mechanics of what goes on in the White House and in the Pentagon. There's all of this other stuff that's, pushing various levers, plus a presidential campaign.
But I agree with that. But first, I'll say, first, that's the job. You wanted the job. And the second thing I'll say is that's why people are supposed to have kind of overarching policy foundations, certain primary principles that guide them. I'm not saying a narrative that you cling to blindly, but you need to, Trump, it was very simplistic, America first, whatever the hell that
means.
But this is why people need kind of a transcendent structure of policy. Because all of these things are going to come up, and it makes it a lot easier to harmonize those when you have a uniform approach.
Mm-hmm.
Every time everything I keep hearing, you know, we did the Iran deal because it was better than, you know, it was better than World War III, right?
Right.
And then we kept appeasing Hamas and giving billions to the PLO.
Well, Netanyahu did, yes.
Yeah, right, Netanyahu, right, of all people.
Let's call it
what it is. And he was clearly wrong, to avoid World War III. You know, and everything is to avoid that. I don't think bombing responding to the Houthi rebels in Yemen is gonna start World War III.
I think that there's all these other buttons that are being pushed. Iran.
But none of them, but we're not pushing any of the buttons. They're all getting pushed against us.
It doesn't matter.
It does.
We are pushing some buttons. We did do that. We did go after the Houthis in Yemen. We are supporting Israel. We are pushing the buttons that we can push right now.
Look, you
without declaring war.
I could respond in a cynical way by saying I think that in a presidential election year, I don't think Biden's going to do a thing directly to Iran that's going to impede the flow of oil through the Straits of Hormuz, right?
Yeah.
Which is a way higher percentage than what we're talking about off of Yemen, because that's going to boost the price of gasoline, and Trump is going to say, "Oh, look, you know." So I think I agree with you. I think there's politics, but I think it's on both sides. Mm-hmm. And I would hate to think that us not wanting to raise the price of gas in an election year is allowing our men and women on these ships to be targets of the rebels when we could be doing more. And I think that part of that was to bring it back. I think part of that was Austin giving bad advice. And I think this might be a propitious time for mm-hmm. him to attend to his health, right, and they shake hands and part friends.
10 points for propitious. JP.
I agree with parts of both Libby and Rich, but on the Houthis, I'm surprised that we have how many active duty military members and we can't put a couple of United States soldiers on each ship. And if people try and take over the ship, that they get shot. That seems like a reasonable response to me.
I was surprised
if the ship wants us. I mean, not all these ships would want us, but that's up to them.
I was surprised that they attacked us with 4 gunboats. We got 3 of them, and I'm thinking with the United States Navy, we were only able to hit 3 out of 4 of the rebel gunboats. Like, how were we not able to take all of them out? I will say, I bet the folks on the ships are saying, look, we've taken down every one of those threats before they've actually hit us, you know, and they're probably a lot tougher about it than I am.
But. It's very bad news for the ships, because the ships, if they are getting fired on, they can't go through that strait, and right, they have to then go below the southern coast of Africa, right, and it would. You know, cripple shipping.
Maersk is already doing that. Maersk Lines, you know, one of the biggest shippers. They're already saying they're by hundreds of miles. They're you know, redirecting these ships.
All right, we have letters on this on Lloyd Austin, so I want to get to those, and then we'll move on to other topics. John writes, "Why is all the blame put on Mr. Austin? He is surrounded by staff that know what he said and what he's going to say, and probably write his speeches. They should have stepped up and given the man in intensive care a break." Well, it's a fair point. However, we don't know that those people knew about it either. That's one of the problems.
And he's still in the hospital. How
right.
often? How communicative is he now?
Right.
I mean, the fact of the matter is, he's still in the hospital.
After
That's,
several days
right.
It's now he went in on January 9th into the or I'm excuse me January
right.
1st
right
he was removed moved
Just
from ICO on the
8th right
and now is still hospitalized
right.
So
we don't even know if this guy's going to survive at this point.
That's because we don't know what it is. Right?
And you have to think about how sick you have to be to not be released from a hospital.
Yeah. Right.
I mean,
right.
they throw you out, right?
Well,
generally.
I don't know if they do the same thing at Walter Reed as
they
do it at some of the other hospitals.
Grace wants in. Grace is tagging in. Go ahead.
I just wanted to note, like, at this point, if you're taking a job within the federal government, it's you have a certain responsibility to the people of the United States and to your staff members to let them know what's going on, especially if you're in the hospital for this amount of time. So if it's this serious, then at the very least your staff should be knowing.
Yeah, the only, I agreed, and I said, Libby jumped on me a couple of months ago when I said that about somebody. Yeah. I said, you know, you don't, you take a job.
You kids usually play along so well.
You take a job at the, I believe this, you take a job at the White House, that level job, it's a huge honor, but, you know, you don't get like the benefits of like a family life and work life balance and all those things. The only thing I could think of is that he told his staff, and his staff's maybe this got clogged up at the staff level, but that would have to mean this guy is so uncommunicative now that he was unable to rectify that, and that seems remote as well.
Look, all these people are human, which means they are all vulnerable to every single bacterial and viral infection that's going around. And I can tell you, we were home from the 22nd until way after New Year's because we both got sick. You know, people are getting sick. And so, and if you get COVID, it totally knocks you out. I had a bad sinus infection. It totally knocked me out. Right. So, you know, and these people are human beings. And so who knows how much, I'm not making excuses, but who knows how much the viral load in Washington, D.C. is actually affecting our ability to govern because people are getting so sick. I mean, I just had two people text me yesterday, I have COVID. I'm like, you know, and these are people I hugged last week.
Grace is going to end up being your chief of staff.
Yeah, right.
But also, like, when you think about Washington, D.C., you have all these people coming in from international locations, too. So all of these ambassadors are bringing in
whatever.
Yeah. And so
I'll give you all of that.
Yeah. We're not blaming the dude for being sick.
No.
We're blaming him for not telling anybody.
Yeah, it's the communication that seems bothersome here.
Yes.
We could make a big deal about if the president knew. But we didn't know for 4 days. That would be a big deal too, but it would be much different. The fact that key members of his staff, key members of the Defense Department, and key members of the White House staff, including the President of the United States, didn't know and apparently were kept in the dark for 4 days. That seems pretty
surprising. Is it regular procedure for the president not to talk to the Secretary of Defense for 4 days, or is that kind of how things run?
Anybody from defense?
Yeah, who knows?
We don't know.
Yeah.
So I think what we're saying is it should not be regular procedure in the midst of everything that's going on right now for him not to have high-level communications with the Defense Department where somebody would say, hey, how's Lloyd doing?
Could he appoint a acting defense secretary in the meantime?
Oh, Biden?
Yeah,
probably.
I was also going to say that according to media reports that he was active from, he was a part of a meeting with the president on Monday. I assume remotely, obviously, and then Friday. So there were meetings taking place, but again, he still didn't know. I mean, the president still didn't know that he was sick, and the fact that
that's
wouldn't
even
come
worse,
up,
if
right?
True.
Right? I mean, it's like, oh, well, you think you'd bring that up, and
maybe he was on, but they put him on mute or something.
I don't know,
Lloyd. Why don't you have your video on? No, I'm good.
You know, we can all.
I haven't brushed my hair. I haven't shaved yet.
Disregard the beeping you hear. Yes.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's all conjecture.
I know. Understand that.
Let's move on.
Okay, I'm going to move on, but we just have a few more letters, and then we'll take a break, and then we'll move on to other stuff because Libby told us to.
You know, it's kind of like,
says,
without being cliched, it's sort of like beating a dead horse. So, you know, we're saying the same thing.
C says, this smells like a major cardiac event, which, depending on severity, involves hours of sedation with uncertain outcomes. Secretary Austin probably literally could not talk. You are all correct about how it was handled, but give the man a break. A skilled and capable Secretary of Defense is crucial at this time, but the Republicans will beat Biden over the head about this again and again, writes Fred. Biden is a decent and compassionate man, but the smart political move is to fire him. And finally, Susan writes, I'm sure he was there for a private matter like bariatric surgery. He was probably just embarrassed. Well,
Get over it.
I mean,
right? I mean, I don't know.
On
Again,
some level, it's none of our business.
Yeah, I disagree.
I agree with you. It's none of our business as to what.
Yeah, I don't care why he's sick. I don't care.
Right.
I don't care if the guy had cosmetics.
Right,
I don't
right,
care.
That's
none
of our business.
That I don't care. You're right.
What is our business is making sure we have a functional Secretary of Defense.
Right. That's right. And that's our business. And if he is in the hospital and he is incapacitated in some way, shape, or form,
right.
It seems at very least the President of the United States should know about
yes.
it. Yes. Yeah. All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and we'll move into the home stretch. Rich, you're going to head out, but thank you very much.
Great seeing
you,
buddy. Great meeting you.
Very nice to have you on the program as always, and we'll see you soon. We're going to go to a little business, and then we're going to take a news break with the BBC. And when we return, we will go to our final topics for this Tuesday morning with Libby and Grace and JP. We'll be back right after this.
Be boarded up, Carnival.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. Libby, please reintroduce our special guest this morning.
Our special guest is Grace Kwiatkowski, who is my full-time graduate intern from the Rockefeller College of School of Public Affairs and Policy. And she's been great. She started January 3rd, and she hasn't run away yet. So it's all really good.
It's very, very good. Yeah. And we welcome her. She's been taking part in the program. Rich had had a meeting and had to leave, but so Grace will be filling in, and that's fine. And J.P. Miller here as well. So we welcome your letters on our issues today. We are going to move on to other things as we move through the news today, but some interesting stories. I was initially a little skeptical because they were very similar to the docket yesterday, but I do want to talk about the spending plan drama that mm-hmm. is taking place in Washington, D.C. We're used to this, of course. But Congress on Monday began an uphill push to pass a new bipartisan spending agreement into law in time to avoid a partial government shutdown next week, with Speaker Mike Johnson encountering stiff resistance from his far-right flank to the deal he struck with Democrats. Ultra-conservative House Republicans have panned the $1.66 trillion agreement that Mr. Johnson made with Senator Chuck Schumer, the New York Democrat and majority leader, saying it is entirely unacceptable. The agreement essentially hews to the bargain that Congress passed last year to suspend the debt ceiling, which the hard right opposed at the time and had hoped to scale back. It also includes $69 billion in spending that was added as a side deal, money that conservatives sought to block altogether. The far-right House Freedom Caucus, a group of Republicans who have proved to be a thorn in the side of a series of GOP House speakers, wrote on social media, "This is a total failure. I am a no to the Johnson-Schumer budget deal," Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, the right-wing Republican from Georgia, wrote on social media. "This $1.6 trillion budget agreement does nothing to secure the border, stop the invasion, or stop the weaponized government targeting Biden's political enemies and innocent Americans." The backlash from the extreme right underscored anew that Mr. Johnson will most likely have to rely on substantial Democratic support to pass the spending bills underlying the agreement. It also raised questions about the viability of his plan to try to attract Republican backing to spending measures by inserting conservative policy dictates aimed at restricting abortion rights and what Republicans see as, quote, woke administration policies. Democrats say they will fight the addition of such policy riders.
Don't pass the budget. Go for a government shutdown. It always works so well for Republicans in November to do that. They will be blamed for the government being shut down, and they will feel it at the ballot box. These yahoos, the Freedom Caucus, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, all the rest of them, they're just gaslighting their supporters
You know, I mean, Trump has made it clear that he'll weaponize the DOJ against the people he doesn't like. So give me a break. You know, Biden is not doing that. You want to think that what's going on with Trump is weaponizing government. It's really about the fact that no one is above the law. Not me, not Donald Trump, not Joe Biden, not Richard Nixon. Remember, he resigned. Right. So, you know, what's going to happen here is this will pass. Because Hakeem Jeffries will make sure that he hasn't that there's enough Democrats behind this, because this is an agreement negotiated with Chuck Schumer, and he won't need the big Republican base to do this, but it will definitely weaken Johnson's position, and I have a feeling we might have a new speaker in a couple of months because these guys are out of their minds and they don't get that government is about compromise.
Yeah, I think that before the deal even came out, the idea that Marjorie Taylor Greene was going to agree with a spending plan that Chuck Schumer also likes is just that's never going to happen. So I think and hope that Speaker Johnson is coming from a baseline point that he is going to, as Libby said, rely on Hakeem Jeffries to deliver moderate Democratic votes to get this passed to avoid a government shutdown. I also think that that maybe different from the Marjorie Taylor Greene crew, that the crew of Republicans in Congress that are hoping to win the election in 2024 know that this is not the winning issue for Republicans to run on, and that they want to get something passed and move on to other issues of conversation and not the government shutdown.
You know, the fact of the matter is that the Freedom Caucus represents states where they use a lot of this money that comes from the government in programs like SNAP and aid to women with dependent children and all of that sort of stuff. So all they're doing is, you know, rattling their sabers and will ultimately hurt their own constituents, who are not smart enough to understand what's going on.
This is, I would say, a potential government shutdown. We are a ways off from it, yeah. But it is different than a default. We have never defaulted, and we have had a number of government shutdowns in the past, the most recently being, I think, in 2018 and 2019. But yes, I think Speaker Johnson is seeing that this is a very tough job. I guess he knew that going in, but he has not been, from my perception, on the public stage yet as Speaker. Right. I don't know that I've ever even seen an interview with Speaker Johnson before, but this will be his first big test and his first time really under the national spotlight. And it will be interesting to see how he juggles the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world while trying to get votes from Hakeem Jeffries.
Yeah, and we saw there was nothing about abortion in this budget negotiation. The right wing wanted, you know, to take money away and outlaw it and do the whole nine yards. And there was nothing about that in this budget. And there won't be.
Republicans have seen and know that the abortion issue has come to hit them in the face in the last two elections, and that over and over, state right. after state after state that you think are going to be conservative states, this is a losing issue. They know that. I think that, you know, you look at what are big elections about. If the election this November is about abortion, Republicans are likely to lose. If the election is about illegal immigration, they have the potential to win. So they want to stay as far away from, I think, from abortion as they can.
Except that they can't. If the Supreme Court decides that mifepristone, I can't always pronounce it, is not...
You better than I do.
Yeah, I know. I can see it. I just can't pronounce it. If they decide it's the morning after pill, it's the medical abortion pill. If they make this decision that it shouldn't be available because it's just another way of having an abortion and throwing it all back to the states, once again, you're going to have this. I mean, abortion is not going away as an issue in this upcoming election, regardless of what the Supreme Court does around the abortion pill, but women are energized and it will be one of those issues. And now even Trump is sort of like trying to dance around it.
He hugely backtracked.
Right. After, he has.
He put up the three conservative justices to
He knows. And women know. And so it's still going to be an issue. Look, Ohio voted to keep it safe. And Ohio's one of the more, it's a swing state, right? And so those people who voted to keep it safe aren't going to go vote for Trump.
It also, a lot of people say, well, when people are polled, abortion isn't, the top issue. But all that needs to change in these swing states are a couple, 10, 20, 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 votes to swing on that. And what you could see as a very vulnerable incumbent in Joe Biden, that just those votes could be enough to swing it back in his favor for reelection.
And let's not forget, in 2016, the polling showed Hillary was going to win. No one was willing to say they were going to vote for Trump, right? And the abortion issue is in those states. It's hard. I think it's hard for women to talk to somebody who they have no idea who this person is, whether it's a push poll or not, right? To say, yes, this is an important issue for me, because they don't know what the ramifications are going to be. I mean, we've got some states that are looking at, the easy pass records to see if somebody went out of state to get an abortion. I mean, it's we're living the Handmaid's Tale in 2024. And women are seen as chattel, and it's all about control of women. That's all this is about.
And the Republican coalition has historically and continues to be in many ways a coalition of religious conservatives and fiscal conservatives. And many of those fiscal conservatives, even in what you might think of Southern or more religious states, a lot of those fiscal conservative men, too, are not a fan of not allowing their women to have those choices.
Right. It's and especially the ones they knock up out of wedlock.
Oh, Jesus.
So,
Grace, it's anything you'd like to add?
I mean, I had that thought too. I just wasn't going to say it. But I
what kind of workplace you running over there? Go ahead.
I think that polling, especially nowadays, people don't really want to say that they want to vote for Trump unless they're super, super conservative and, will publicly say that they like him, not necessarily just his policies. So I think that even if abortion isn't the issue, it will still sway the undercurrent, which will influence everything else. Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't show up in polls until the day after Election Day. Exactly. And they go, look at what happened. Yeah. We didn't see that in the polls.
Right. Exactly.
And I mean, and am I right here? But that's three election cycles we've seen then, right?
What do you mean?
Meaning that we've seen it
I think you'd be correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
To be an issue.
Yes.
Swaying an election.
Oh, yeah.
And three election cycles.
Oh, yeah. 2018, 2020, 2022.
All right, let's go to, let's see, we got about 2 minutes. So just our final topic today of the last thing. Well, I'll go to letters, actually, is what I'll do.
Okay, fine.
good morning. Who are the people continuing to vote for people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and the like? I'm baffled by the incompetence of our public servants. Well, that's it. I mean, they have the support, right?
Yeah.
I think we just don't know that kind of lifestyle living in New York. Like, people that live in the South have a very different...
Georgia is different.
Yeah. Very different culture, very different lifestyle, I guess.
David says, I believe what's going to decide this election is how much of the black vote that Biden loses because immigration is outrageous and the black community is done. This was actually the next issue I was going to bring up, which we don't have time for, and that is Biden courting the black vote in South Carolina yesterday. And how tough a sell do you think that is for him, Libby?
I don't think it's going to be that tough a sell. I think there's a game of diminishing expectations going on everywhere. And I think the black leadership will come out for Biden, and the majority of the black community will come out and vote for him. All we need to do, and I'm sure the Biden people and the Lincoln Project people will be doing this, is, some of Trump's remarks, talking about there's very good people on both sides of Charlottesville, you know, not coming out against church shootings, you know, being silent around issues regarding black Americans and police. So, I think ultimately the black community will support Trump. The community that
Biden,
Biden. The community that's up in the air for me more is the Latinx community.
Right, which has been the case for the last several election cycles.
Right.
We have to put a bookmark in it there and hold. We'll be back with more conversation tomorrow. My thanks to our wonderful group. Grace, a delight to meet you. Thank you very much for taking part and for the great work you're doing with Libby. And congratulations on your time there. Libby, as always, thank you very much. J.P. Miller of the Empire Report, thank you. We'll be back right after this.